I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, welcome to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. Get a load of this. One of the most sought-after violinists in the entire world, like the person that every orchestra wants to play with, comes from Brandon, Manitoba. Population 50,000. James Ennis has played in some of the most famous concert halls with the best orchestras. He's won a Grammy. He's a member of the Order of Canada. He won a Juno Award this past weekend. Congratulations for Classical Album of the Year, solo artist. I also want to say that even if you don't think that you are into classical music, you're listening to this right now, you're like, it's not my thing. This is just a great conversation with a person who is at the top of their game and has a lot to say about how art gets made. James joined Tom Power in the studio a little while back when he was in town playing with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and he actually brought his violin in with him, not to play, but because it's very expensive and you cannot just leave that in a green room or a hallway somewhere. James is a true superstar. He plays all around the world, and Tom started by asking him about what it feels like to play at home. Here's their conversation.
How are you?
Hey, good. Great to be here.
How's it feel? Canadian shows mean anything to you?
Yeah, well, you know, it's home. It'll always be home. And it's great to be back up here. And yeah, it's a really special week. It's nice to have kind of a significant amount of time. You know, sometimes the nature of my job, it's like I'll come in for these, you know, strategic strikes, like 48 hours or something.
Really?
And to be here for a week working with the Toronto Symphony, you know, these people are kind of like my musical family. I realized that coming up in January, it'll be 30 years since the first time I played with the Toronto Symphony. So that's, it's significant to be here. Really nice.
You started when you played with the Toronto Symphony and you were two for the first time.
Something like that.
You grew up in Brandon, Manitoba. No disrespect to Brandon, Manitoba, but when I read you say, and I was doing research for this interview, and I read you say something like, there's no better place to grow up to end up doing what I ended up doing with my life. I don't mean any disrespect. I didn't quite know. Because typically you would expect something like that from Montreal or Toronto or something like that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that what I'm going to say about Brandon is kind of, in a way, a uniquely Canadian type of thing. You know, the nature of the size of our country and the way that the population is dispersed, you find these real hotbeds of a certain kind of activity in what might be seen as unlikely places. And Brandon, Manitoba, you know, Brandon University has had this kind of legendary music school for decades. And it's a very special place for a lot of reasons, but I think that in a way the way that the school was set up was, if you want to go somewhere to really immerse yourself in your work, to feel like you have a real connection with a smaller school, with a smaller faculty, Brandon was set up to be this type of a place. And this remarkable man named Lauren Watson went around the country hiring the best music, well, around the world, really, hiring the best music professors he could back in, I guess, the 60s. And then in the early 70s, sort of the second round of these hires, they hired a trumpet professor, and that was my dad. And that's how he ended up there. And then, you know, they started a family, and we grew up there. And it was a great place to grow up. I mean, my violin teacher, Francis Chaplin, had just a huge and lasting influence on the classical music scene across the country. I mean, there are members of virtually every orchestra studied with him, and he was my father's kind of closest friend. So that was one of those things that just you look back on and kind of marvel at the serendipity of a situation like that. And I really mean it, that there's nowhere else where I think I could have received that kind of incredible attention from so many wonderful musicians. I mean, the faculty of music there have remained incredibly important people in my life. And yeah, I think it's I think it's something really worth celebrating that that in Canada you can thrive in these kind of unusual areas. You don't have to go to Toronto. You don't have to go to Montreal.
I want to play you a clip that I know was also a part of the inspiration. Take a listen to this.
Well, Mr. Perlman, you take the high part and I'll take the low part, all right?
Okay.
No, I should warn you that the low part is the fun part. Oh. Do you still want to play with
me? I'd love to.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us what we're listening to right now?
You know, it took me a second. That first voice.
Is that Tom Waits?
I don't think I know this person. Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah, Sesame Street. That is Sesame Street with the great violinist Itzhak Perlman. Yeah, you know, I remember as a little kid seeing, it may have been this very episode, seeing Itzhak Perlman on Sesame Street and thinking, oh, that guy's just the coolest. I want to do that. And I'd sort of wondered over the years if maybe that was how I made that connection between what a violin sounded like and what a violin actually was. You know, it was my parents, their record collection. I was always hearing instruments, but somehow or another at a really young age, I did make the connection between what instruments made what sounds. And yeah, I decided that I really wanted a violin. And most people, understandably, when they know that my father was a musician, my mother was a dancer at a ballet school in town, and they think, oh, well, your parents probably gave you an instrument and told you to play it. And it really wasn't like that at all. I kind of had this intense desire to play a violin. And they were like, well, okay, we'll give it a try, see how it goes.
Were you good at it, like, naturally right away?
You know, I think so, or at least in a way. I mean, the funny thing about playing the violin is I mean, you really sound terrible for quite a while.
I mean, God, listen, I tried and I couldn't get past I still every now and then will pick it up and go, I should say playing fiddle, but every now and then I'll pick it up and I'll go, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah.
And I can't get past the first 10 minutes of sounding like that.
You know, it's too bad because I think that people, they often talk about this with music and with instruments in general, but I think with violin in particular, they say, well, you know, you got to start young if you haven't started young. And I think that that's discouraging sometimes because people have this idea like, well, if, you know, maybe I'm 12 or 14 and, you know, it's too late for me now. And, you know, I don't think that there's anything to that except the fact that you, when you're really little, you just don't mind how bad you sound. It's, you know, it's not like somehow there's something magical that happens that you lose when you're older. I think that it's just older students get so discouraged because it takes a while to sound decent. But, I mean, all that being said, I think that I did have sort of a natural ability for it. And I think that I had also an incredible amount of encouragement because my parents as teachers and my father as a music teacher in particular did recognize that I had an ability and, you know, gave me such great, you know, encouragement. And kids always want to feel like they're doing well at something. And I had just such great support around me. And I know that that was really, really important.
What happens when you're 12 or 11 and you start to realize that you might be better than other kids your age at this instrument, that you might have a bit of a thing?
You know, it was, for me, the realization of kind of where I was within a small community happened pretty early on because I was involved with the Suzuki method. It's this sort of, well-known method for learning instruments. And so there was my sort of group of peers, and I recognized from early on that I was able to advance more quickly than them. And, you know, my parents, they framed it in a way of it, you know, you need to be sort of accountable to your own abilities and to be grateful for...
Accountable to your own abilities?
Well, you know, I think that when you're lucky enough to... I think everybody's good at something. I really strongly believe that. And when you're lucky enough to recognize what it is, to find out what it is that you're good at, And when it's something that you actually really like to do, you need to recognize how lucky you are for that. And I think that's what I mean about being sort of responsible to your talent, you know, because there are so many people that, you know, I've worked really hard. Like, yeah. I definitely am not going to shortchange myself in terms of the amount of effort that I've put into it. But I know that there are a lot of people that have worked just as hard and have wanted it just as much. And I think that was something that was kind of hammered home to me at an early age, is that if you love it and you recognize that you're good at it, it's kind of a responsibility to develop that talent as much as you can, because not everyone who wants it as much as you is going to have that much ability to work. And so, yeah, it's kind of a weird thing to talk about, but I think, and you know, now that I'm raising children myself, it's something I try to instill in them as well, you know, it's sort of a responsibility to your own gifts and talents.
Does the normal childhood nerves exist when you're playing at that level? Like when you play with the Montreal Symphony when you were what, like 13?
Yeah. I'd won this competition, and part of the prize, I mean, really the whole reason I'd entered it was that if you won the first prize, you got to play with the orchestra. And of course, it's such a legendary orchestra. And I was out in Montreal, and the night before, I was with these family friends, and all they had some boys around my age, and we were all playing basketball out in there. Yeah, you can see where this is going, right?
No.
I sort of jammed a finger a little bit. I mean, it wasn't like terrible or anything, but I just
Like you hurt your finger?
Oh yeah, on the middle finger on my left hand. I was like, I can't believe that this has happened, and I wouldn't tell anybody. You know, I was like, no, I'm not going to say a word to anyone. So, in a weird way, it was a good kind of distraction to have, in a way. I think that that could have been a situation where I would have just been sort of paralyzed by the moment, you know, by the enormity of the moment and the opportunity. But instead, it was like, okay, is my finger feeling all right? Okay, well, if I have to, you know, do this to sort of negotiate certain things, and it really kept my eye on the ball, so to speak.
James, I can't imagine that, like, all right, I'm 13 years old and I got to play with one of the best symphonies in North America tomorrow because I won a contest and I hurt my finger the night before. What goes through your mind at that moment?
You know, it's one of those things. you just feel so incredibly dumb. And it wasn't like I hurt it badly, but I hurt it
enough.
But then it's interesting how I think that a lot of performers would agree that when you get into the heat of the moment, it's amazing what adrenaline will do, you know, how you won't necessarily be as aware of certain pains or discomforts. You know, it's like how when you're performing, I mean, I've been playing for like 35 years on stage, and I don't remember sneezing during a performance ever. You know, it's like these weird little mechanisms that take over. You know, sometimes you'll have like a nasty cold, but you feel awful right up until the moment that you get on stage, and then you feel okay, and then you feel awful once you get off stage. So, you know, things like that, I think that that's sort of common, but I think I'm also lucky that that my adrenaline tends to sort of override these feelings of, you know, injury or sickness or whatever.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to talk to you a little bit about the idea of like presence when you're performing these pieces of music. And sometimes the pieces of music that you've performed, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times, you're getting up and doing in front of an orchestra. And I want to get to that in a second. But I just kind of want to talk about process a little bit, because I was talking to a couple of friends of mine who are violinists, and they were very excited that you were coming in. And I guess I have some questions that they were curious about, and I have some questions that I was curious about. The first thing that I was curious about is a little bit of process, if you don't mind. So let's say you're taking on like a big, well-known piece, like a Beethoven sonata or something like that. What's your first step there? Are you reading the score? Are you going to find other violinists who you really admire and listening to their recordings? Are you focusing on technique? Let's make sure it gets underneath my fingers. Mm. Are you thinking about what's the emotion, what's the story behind the piece, and make sure you're imbuing it?
At this point, the kind of core repertoire,
yeah.
I've known this stuff for so long. Like there aren't so many pieces within the kind of inner circle of the repertoire that I haven't already spent a lot of time kind
right.
of figuring out.
Right.
So in general, with pieces of music that aren't new, you know, if it's new, then you have to start from, of course, from zero. If it's a piece that is sort of part of the repertoire, maybe it's been played, it's been maybe recorded. I think there's certainly no harm in listening to see what your colleagues or what great violinists of the past have done with it. But ultimately, you sort of have to forget all that, or it becomes part of the story, but you have to come at it from your own angle. And yeah, I think that for me, the process generally is kind of scratch through it to sort of get a sense of the proportions, a sense of the structure, because I'm a big believer in sort of musical architecture, so to speak. And that's in everything from, you know, you could be talking about a 90-minute symphony, or you can be talking about like a 2.5-minute pop song. I mean, there is a form mm-hmm. and a proportion to it that has to work in a particular way. I think the idea is that by the time you're ready to perform a piece, you have a total understanding of what that story is. That's really the way I've been thinking about it for a while now, and making the metaphor to, I mean, it is storytelling, right? And if you don't really remember how that joke ends, like, don't start telling the joke,
right? Right.
We've all had that experience.
So make sure you really know it. Make sure you really know the structure and the form and your embody the piece.
Right, like what it is you're trying to say. And
are you doing biographical details? Are you going like, okay, this is where Mozart was at this part of his life. This is when Beethoven wrote this. He was deaf at this point, or he was in love with this. He wasn't writing him back, or he was writing, you know. Like, this is the original, not getting texted back and being left unread.
Is the princess ghosting me?
Yeah.
I think that...
I love how there's like eight classical music people who get this joke, by the way. But... Are you worrying yourself with any of them?
Just because you brought it up, I think I will say that it sometimes is a frustration of mine that people sometimes try to explain great art through situations that the artist was dealing with, as if it somehow is an explanation of their genius.
Okay.
You know, I heard this amazing interview with the great conductor Lauren Mazel before a performance of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. You know, this piece that is very tragic and ends very tragically, and the interviewer, it was one of those interviews where the interviewer was not really asking questions, but was just trying to get Lauren Mazel to verify his already firm thoughts on the subject.
I wouldn't know anything about that, James. I wouldn't.
Lauren Mazel was just, it was so funny. I mean, he was just like dripping with disdain.
Yeah.
Because this guy was basically saying, well, you know, we can hear Tchaikovsky's sorrow and we can hear his upcoming suicide. And we can understand this music through the references of his life. And Mazel was having none of it. And he said, listen, Tchaikovsky was a great genius. He was a genius on a level that we can't understand and we can't explain it. He could write sad music when he was happy, and he could write happy music when he was sad, because he was really, really great, and he was just better than us. And you know what? Sometimes there might be parallels, but it cheapens it to, you know, of course people are writing out of experience, but they're writing out of skill and
yeah.
out of, you know, the genius of artists to portray these inner emotions that may or may not reflect what's going on in their life. You know, people love to take a look at like the last music of Mozart's, you know, final year and say, oh, well, you know, you can hear that he senses the end is coming. It's like, no, that's not true. You know, sorry, it was 1791 and he got sick and he died. And that's awful. But it wasn't like somehow he saw this coming like a year early. He wrote music full of this incredible poignancy because he was just really, really a great genius. And if that makes people uncomfortable, it's like, well, sorry, you know, I'm not Mozart. You're not Mozart. Nobody is. He was very, very special. So all this to say that I like to take a look at the biographical elements and see them as part of the story. But I also like to, I just find myself so impressed by these artistic minds that, you know, it's my greatest joy to try to get inside these creations that, and, you know, to breathe life in them, into them, and tell this story the way that I think it comes across. And that's the great thing about live performances. You know, the same way, like I was saying, you tell a joke and you know how that joke goes. You might have told this joke 50 times, but if you've got a different group of friends, you tell it a little differently. You say it a little differently if you're saying it to one person, if you're saying it to three people, if you're saying it to 50 people. All of this becomes part of the equation. It doesn't mean that you change the ending or that somehow it becomes a different story, but communicating that message and reading a room and understanding sort of the collective atmosphere in the concert hall, that's the most incredible sensation. And of course, that was the hardest thing to lose, I think, when the halls were all closed during COVID. I mean, not being able to sort of get that feedback that is so difficult to explain.
I love that, because I think I, as a classical music fan, but someone who does not play that music, who comes from traditional music and comes from folk music, which of course is so imbued in story and lived experience and all that, you know, you're hearing farmers sing about, you know, droughts that happened in the 1700s. And of course I'm thinking, my God, they were going through a drought in the 1700s. Mm-hmm. This is beautiful. I never thought about that before. I love that we can also just accept that Rachmaninoff was a really great composer. We can also accept that Mahler was a complicated, great composer.
Yeah.
These things. I mean, that's a great insight into the way you think about music. I'm really grateful to you for that.
I guess he sounds all right. That's James Ennis, unbelievable player, and the first movement to Handel's Violin Sonata in D Major. That's from James's latest album with pianist Andrew Armstrong. The album's called Mitt. I'm still thinking about what James said about how great artists are writing out of experience, of course, but they're actually writing out of skill, and how maybe even diminishes their genius to try and explain their work just using the facts of their lives. I love that. Coming up, James has some more surprising things to say about practicing the violin, and also what happens when you are one of the best players in the world and then you try to just hang out and play basketball with your buddies. More James Ennis in just a bit. Plus, you'll hear from musician Caroline Rose. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. More Q in a minute.
Favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to Q. I'm Talia Schlanger in for Tom Power. Right now, you're listening to one of the great violin players of our time, James Ennis. You're hearing a little bit of Aaron J. Kernis's Violin Concerto, a piece written for and performed by James. It won him his latest Grammy. I say latest Grammy. James is one of the best violin players out there right now. And in the second part of his conversation with Tom Power, Tom asked how much time James spends practicing.
I don't know. I like to be very efficient. And I feel like I've always been, it's always been a big part of my life is trying to be as efficient as possible with everything. Because there's a lot of things I like to do. You know, I there are some people, and I kind of love this, like some of my colleagues, the only thing they really like to do is play the violin. Like, they just love it. They love it so much. And I'm like, that's great. I'm really glad you love it. Like, I love it too. But I also really like to, like, go to the beach and hang out with my kids and do this and the other. And so, I'm not one to, generally speaking, just spend lots and lots of time if I don't kind of need to because
go
there are
8 hours a day with the metronome.
Because there are the periods where that's exactly what I'm doing and that's exactly what I have to do. You know, it's just hour after hour after hour after hour. I mean, there will be, you know, so when people are like, how much are you playing? It's like, well, I don't know. You know, if I can take a day or two away from the violin, I will. Like, I definitely will do that. Whereas some of my friends and colleagues, like they can't, like they just get too kind of antsy about it.
And just don't play basketball on those days.
Oh man, I love basketball. That's a problem. It's like, I still love basketball. And I remember this is going back about 10 years now, but still I was playing with the orchestra that's basically like my hometown orchestra now, the Sarasota Orchestra in Florida, and this wonderful group of people down there, just great orchestra, great people. And there's a whole bunch of guys there that are right around my same age. And it was during a set of performances I was playing a concerto with them, and we went to, like, oh, should we play a little basketball? And I knew, I was like, oh, I shouldn't play basketball. But I was like, well, I don't know. Maybe let's just play a little bit of basketball. And so we're playing, you know, like 3-on-3 or something. And I was just like on fire. I was unstoppable. I felt like LeBron James. I mean, it was incredible until the moment that it hit me that I'm like, no one is coming within 4 feet of me.
Oh, yeah.
Like, no one was going to be the one to bust my fingers in the middle of that.
I wonder why I'm playing
so
well.
I was like, darn it. You know, I thought I was really making a breakthrough with my basketball game.
We asked our colleague Robert Rowett from Classical Music Producer at CBC for help researching you for this interview, and he was really, really, really helpful. So, in gratitude to Robert, we asked, and he's the biggest classical music nerd I know. I asked if he had a question for you. So, I don't even know what this is.
James, I look forward to each new album you release, especially the violin concertos. You've recorded the Barber and Korngold concertos, the Mendelssohn, Bartok, and Tchaikovsky concertos, Britten, Elgar, Shostakovich, Dvorak. But I'm holding my breath for two in particular, Sibelius and Brahms. I want to know, what are you waiting for, and when will the time be right for those concertos?
Well, hello, Robert. Okay, Sibelius.
I didn't expect him to put you on the spot this much. I thought I was going to be like, oh, tell me a little bit about your bow arm or, you know.
No, I like that. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, those are kind of the core pieces. Those are the ones that are, I think, kind of noticeable holes in my discography. And it's there's nothing on purpose about it. It's I learned kind of early on in the recording business, the best advice I got was take the best opportunities as they come to make the projects that are most special. And so I think sometimes what can happen is people will have an idea. They're like, well, I need to record this piece. And well, how are you going to do that? Well, I don't know. Just, you know, find an orchestra, find a conductor. And you hear all these kind of nightmare stories of people getting thrown together for collaborations where there's no chemistry, there's no rehearsal, there's really no reason for it to happen. And, you know, that's not a great way of making art. So I've always enjoyed when the pieces come together for it to be like, okay, now is the perfect time and the perfect set of circumstances to record the Elgar Concerto or the Tchaikovsky Concerto or whatever. And that just kind of didn't happen for a long time with these pieces. And then in recent years, it's been just incredibly frustrating. As Sibelius Concerto, I'm very happy to say that I did record it. I just did that in August.
Scoop. That's a scoop right there.
This was a project that was planned for June of 2020. Didn't happen for obvious reasons.
Yeah, right,
rescheduled to August of 2020. Didn't happen for also obvious reasons. The summer of 21 didn't happen again. Mm-hmm. Summer of 22, and then was replaced by a different bit of repertoire of Nielsen that we recorded and that was subsequently released. And so finally it happened. And then the other one with the Brahms, this is also a project that has fallen through three separate times with three separate organizations. So it will be coming soon, I'm sure.
Robert.
Come on, Robert. Give me a break, man.
I got to play some basketball at some point in my life, for God's sake. Right. You know the other thing he told me, though? He told me that he's coming across so many young violinists in Canada who are – he can tell in the way they stand, in the way they approach the instrument, that they're emulating James Ennis.
Well, that's awfully nice. You know, it's kind of an amazing thing how – you know, it goes back to this idea we've been touching upon this whole time of storytelling, you know, and so much of all performance art is kind of handing down these traditions of telling stories, and you recognize that you become part of this long line of people that recognize the value of this art and want to share it with other people. And you know, as I have gotten older, you know, teaching has become a bigger and bigger part of my life, and I recognize now, you know, what it was for my father that drew him into that world, and why that was so special to him. You know, to be able to, you know, you spend so much time thinking about this stuff, and you come up with concepts and ideas that you really believe in, and to have the platform, I suppose, to be able to share that is really meaningful.
We're going to go out on you playing the piece. You're playing with the TSO, right? You're here to play the Barber.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to go out on Samuel Barber's Violin Concerto. It's a rare opportunity to get to talk to someone like you, and I'm glad we're having such like a fun chat, but it's rare to have someone of your level talk to me about this music. I wonder if you could set this up a little bit. Let us know what we should be listening for.
Well, you know, Barber was a really extraordinary American composer who at heart was a very lyrical songwriter, I think is how I would put it. Living and working during a period of time where the so-called classical music world was often quite, I don't know, quite divided. And he was not necessarily on the popular side of this, in that he wrote music, the easiest way of putting it is he wrote music that people liked to listen to at a point where there was a lot of music being written that was about, you know, dissonance and sort of tragedy.
A lot of atonal music,
experimental, yeah, very difficult harmonic music that can be wonderful and really exciting. But like I say, Barber was ultimately a very kind of tonal, beautiful songwriter. For people that are not familiar with his music, like people, a lot of people say, well, I don't think I know any Samuel Barber's music, but you probably do. Because, I mean, his most famous piece is the Adagio for Strings that is featured so prominently in so much of our popular culture. You know, if you've ever seen Platoon.
I think now, looking back, we did not fight the enemy. We fought ourselves. And the enemy was in us.
It's like, well, yeah, I mean, that movie kind of depends on the use of the Adagio for Strings. And the Violin Concerto, the first two movements of his concerto are really in that vein. I mean, the most prominent feature of the music, I think, is just how beautiful and lyrical it is. And it starts, the violin starts right off. You know, there's no orchestral introduction. It's just you sort of are immediately like surrounded by this warm blanket of beauty. As popular as the piece was in America in particular, the piece didn't really travel much, and even to this day is a lot less known in, say, continental Europe. Mm. And I have just kind of through odd circumstance, I've ended up playing the piece in a number of like European capitals where they just didn't know it at all. And it's when you'll hear it now, you know, coming up, you can imagine the pleasure of introducing a piece like this in all of its warmth and beauty to audiences that don't know it. You know, it's a really special thing.
Man, I got to tell you, I was looking forward to having you in all week, and I'm so glad you came in to talk a little bit about this.
I've enjoyed this so much.
Yeah, I had a great time. James Ennis, the Grammy-winning Order of Canada violinist. You're going to hear him right now performing the first movement from Samuel Barber's Violin Concerto.
That's James Ennis, the Grammy-winning Order of Canada-holding violinist. He's performing the first movement from Barber's Violin Concerto from his Grammy Award-winning 2006 album, Barber, Korngold, Walton Violin Concertos. Before that, you heard James' conversation with Tom Power. If you're in Toronto, you can catch James performing with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra May 29th to June 1st. And congrats again to James on winning a Juno Award this past weekend. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Okay, have a listen to a bit of this song by the artist Caroline Rose.
Well, baby, watch me freak out. Can you feel the way I want to? Feel the way I want to? Feel the way I want to feel? Feel the way I want to? Feel the way I want to?
That's Feel the Way I Want To off Caroline Rose's album Superstar. They released it just before the pandemic in 2020. And then Caroline went through a pretty hard time, like a lot of folks. In their particular case, they had a breakup, they were isolated, and they started writing music about it. The result was an album called The Art of Forgetting. It came out last year. It tells the story of the aftermath of a relationship, and the songs are interspersed with voicemails from Caroline's grandmother asking Caroline to call her. There's a song where Caroline talks to her therapist. There's a song about not knowing what comes next. It's an emotional album, and it did really, really well. It picked up a Grammy nomination. It was on Best of Year-End lists. And Caroline toured it in North America and in Europe. But the tour was hard on them. Their grandmother passed away. They were reliving sadness every night, the kind of sadness that you can't really hide. They were breaking into tears every time they played. It was emotionally draining. And Caroline was ready to get off the road for a good while. But now they are hopping back on the bus. And we wanted to check in with Caroline about why, about a tour that's changing the narrative for them and moving the needle from sadness to joy. Caroline dropped by the Q studio to talk to Tom Power. Here's their conversation.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. How are you?
Good. I'm all right. I'm good. How do you feel about all this? Like, can we talk a little bit about that tour that you were on?
Yeah. You know, I don't think I'm the only one talking about how hard touring is right now. It's like emotionally and physically just difficult. Just the price of everything. I mean, the kind of obvious ones. But yeah, then you throw in an incredibly difficult emotional element to it. Just performing songs that were written at your worst. And that kind of, yeah, I guess it kind of tipped me over.
Can you explain to me, like, how you were feeling on stage when you were singing these songs?
Well, I knew it was going to be hard, and I knew that going into it. I was like, well, this could either be really healing or be a complete disaster. And turns out it was both. It was definitely both.
Well, let me do healing first.
Yeah.
You were going through these like really tough and complex emotions. How was it healing?
I think it was kind of an act of ripping a Band-Aid, a very large and rough Band-Aid to rip. But every night that we did the show, you know, I was just crying. Like, it was impossible not to. And I don't know if that's just a testament of the songs being good. I don't know. I don't know what it was, or if I was still kind of reliving those moments and I hadn't fully moved on yet. But by the end of it, I knew I desperately needed a break, and at the same time felt like I had moved on. So I guess it was just a way of processing my emotions in real time.
Someone asked me the other day, like, if I could describe to them what a panic attack feels like. And I was able to do it. I was able to like tell them like, hey, this is what happens when you're, you know, you lose your breath and you start having these, you know, and I was able to do it. Can you describe for me what it actually feels like when you're, because you're not on stage thinking, oh, I'm going to start crying. I'm planning on starting crying during this music. What does it actually feel like when you're sort of mid-song and that stuff starts to come up?
I just let it happen, and I think that was kind of why it felt healing in a way, because my music has never been vulnerable like this. The way that I liken it is when you're a teenager and you have all these very intense emotions and your hormones are raging and you have nowhere to put them, and so if you start writing songs, they end up being really direct, like, I hate you, Mom, I hate you, Dad, you know, like, just so angsty, and because you have to get it out somehow. And I feel like that was what was happening to me. I was just, I had to get the feelings out. And I really appreciate when artists get up there and can just express themselves. And it didn't feel like a panic attack, but it just felt like a purge of emotion, like really heavy weight that I had been carrying around, just kind of offloading it every time I was performing. So what do we do now? If there's nothing left to say, do we shake hands? Do we embrace? Do we just walk away? Are we becoming someone else?
What toll does that have on you when you have to do it every night after night? When that starts happening to you at night after night, or when that starts coming out night after night?
It's really hard for me to just detach. Because it's my life, you know? I think one big question that I had at the end of the tour was, how do I separate my work life from my personal life when it's my name? Like, my job, my performance, it's all under my name. And I was having a really hard time differentiating between the two.
Go back to the healing parts of this. Like, it sounds like there were, in many ways, this was like a good, in some ways, a good thing. Like, it feels like you got, you know, A, it sounds like you processed some emotion maybe, or you sort of realize something about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that grief is this thing where you can all of a sudden like, oh, I'm just going to walk through this door and then I'm fine. It's, somebody told me it's kind of like hiking a mountain where some days you're going up, some moments you're going down, but overall, you know, eventually you reach the top to a place where you are somewhat stable and secure. And I think for me, it was just, it was exactly that, like going up and down, up and down, up and down, until eventually I got to a place where I'm like, okay, I think I'm in a really good place. Like, I learned from that. I'm stronger because of all these things that have kind of happened, and I feel good to move on.
Can you give me some examples of what you're doing differently on this next run to try and protect yourself a little bit from what happened last time?
Well, we were performing the record in its entirety because I think first and foremost, I'm a storyteller. That's what I do. That's what I'm best at. I come from like a long line in my family of great storytellers. So every time I make an album, I'm really telling a story. And the way to honor that in my mind, it's kind of like making a little movie. I feel like each time I make an album, I'm like making a little movie. And then when we perform it, it's really like acting out the story. And there was something to that. I felt like I was maybe even, I wasn't really acting because it was real. The feelings were real, but I was allowing it to happen in a way that I just don't know how to be any other way. And so we were performing the album in its entirety. And by the end of the album, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like just so intense. And then we'd play the older material that's like upbeat and kind of like uplifting in a lot of ways. And it would be a really weird shift. So this time I'm like, it has to be fun. Like I can't just go out there and just try and pedal this really intense story of grief and kind of getting through this really sad time. It's got to be joyous, you know. So we're trying a bunch of things, and I'm trying to, you know, get some like guest players in there, and maybe, I don't know, have some people sing with us, and we'll see how it goes. But it's definitely it's going to be a lot more joyful, and that's mostly for me.
Well, but I think that's useful, you know. Like I don't know, I spend a lot of time thinking about this, that like the trend towards like deep vulnerability in music in particular, and like performed music, is like relatively new. You know what I mean? Like the singer-songwriter thing is new. You know, for a long time we were singing traditional music from our communities, or we were singing opera.
Yeah, yeah, relatively new in like the, you know,
in the last 100 years.
Yes, yeah.
Relatively new. And then in the last like maybe 5 or 10 or 15 years, I mean this is just my hunch, that we've like really gravitated towards people expressing their vulnerability and like their deepest, darkest secrets and their deepest sadnesses for us in art. And I don't know if we spend enough time thinking about the cost of that.
That's a really good point, yeah.
You know? The cost of that on the performer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually kind of gravitated away from being super vulnerable and almost like diaristic in my music, because there have been so many people that have done it and done it really well. And it's never totally been my thing. I'm like more of a... I don't know. More...
Song and dance.
Yeah, I'm a song and dance man. Yeah. Yeah. But this just like felt different. It felt more out of necessity than like, oh, I'm going to explore this new sonic territory that I haven't tried before. It just felt like I must do it.
So I guess the point I'm making is that like, it's just really nice to hear you talk about putting up some guardrails for yourself around
that. Yeah.
Because I don't know if I think we just expect so much from our performers that we don't think too much about the cost that it might be having on them emotionally to be having this every single night. So I'm glad you're talking about it.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting how much we just accept all of these musicians who have just absolutely gone crazy. And we're just like, oh, we lost another one.
Yeah. Oh, so beautiful. Beautiful, you know. I remember I talked to, this is a name drop, but I've talked to Phoebe Bridgers one time. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do you feel about that you get so much attention for your sad music, you know? And she said, it makes me feel like I wish I wasn't sad. Like, yeah. I feel like there's so much attention, like I get so much praise for being sad, but I would like to not be sad. That would be the goal for me.
That's a really good point, yeah.
You know? So I'm glad you're talking about it. I'm glad you're talking about this. And I can't wait to see the new tour. And I hope you have a blast doing it. Like, literally, a joyful experience doing it.
I'm actually very excited about it, which is a testament to maybe something working. Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I just want to be there for someone completely. A foundation for walls and the ceiling. But better run for cover, cause here I come, can you feel me? The air's getting heavy, they're clutching their rosary beads.
That's Caroline Rose with Everywhere I Go, I Bring the Rain. I like how the bass line gives you a sense of the sadness of that song, maybe if you don't hear it in the groove. It's off their album, The Art of Forgetting. Caroline Rose is going on tour. They will be in Montreal and Toronto on April 9th and 10th. And before this song, you heard their conversation with Tom Power. That's it for Q this week. The show is produced by Ben Edwards, Vanessa Greco, Lise Hossein, Nikki Manfredi, Vanessa Nigro, Cora Nijawan, Mitch Pollack, and Catherine Stockhausen. Our intern is Alphonsine Sefou. Our digital team is Eva Ju, Shuli Grossman-Gray, March Mercanti, and Mackenzie Ribello. Our podcast producer is Caitlin Swan. Our director is Matthew Murphy. Our engineer is Gabby Hagoriles. Our senior producer is Beza Seifa. Anne McKeegan is our executive producer. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. I'll see you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.